David Brooks has a gift for bringing audiences face to face with the spirit of our times. He does so with humor, insight, and passion. He is an observer of the American way of life and an analyst of present-day politics and foreign affairs. He holds several prestigious positions as a commentator, including biweekly op-ed columnist for the New York Times and regular analyst on PBS's NewsHour and NPR's All Things Considered. His newest book, The Road to Character, explains why selflessness leads to greater success. He tells the story of 10 great lives that illustrate how character is developed and how we can all strive to build rich inner lives marked by humility and moral depth in a society that emphasizes success and external achievement. David Brooks is currently teaching a course at Yale University. He will be at Proctor's Theater next Wednesday, January 17th at 7:30. And it is a great pleasure to welcome David Brooks to the roundtable this morning. David, thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you on the program.
Great to be with you.
At what point did you decide that going around and talking to large groups of people in theaters was something you like to do?
It's actually super fun for me because I get to talk beyond just the day's news. I get to talk about the world in general. And I like to make every talk personal about not only about what we're going through as a society, but also how personally to lead our lives. And that includes things like marriage, how to build community, how to lead a meaningful life. So I like to mix in the personal and be a little vulnerable.
Is there a message, though? I mean, people who come to see you, though, probably are interested in talking about what is going on, right?
Yeah, and I think they get enough of the day-to-day headlines. You can just turn on cable TV for that. So I give a little of that kind of inside stuff, but mostly, where are we as a society? What brought us here? And to me, one of the big stories is that a crisis of solidarity. We just have fewer social connections one to another. The number of people who don't have really any friends they can talk to has doubled. The number of people who live alone has increased. The number of people who have people over their home for dinner has decreased. So there's just a tide of loneliness. And I try to tie that into why people were voting for Donald Trump. And then what they're looking for in politics if it's not Donald Trump.
It does seem your last book was on a character, The Road to Character. Did this all sort of come out of that?
I think so. You know, I think that politics flows from culture, from the way we are. And I think politics is a limited activity. It's important. But really, the things that matter most in our lives is the quality of our relationships, whether we're good people. And that book was based on a distinction between what I call the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. The resume virtues are things that make us good at our jobs. The eulogy virtues are the things they say about us after we're dead, whether we're courageous, honest, brave, capable of great love. And my argument there was that we live in a culture that spends a lot more time thinking about the resume virtues than it does about the eulogy virtues. And so, you know, in my case, I've had some really good luck on the career side. But sometimes, about once a month, I meet somebody who just radiates with an inner joy. And I remember thinking, you know, how do I get that? So I wanted to learn how to get that thing, that just the sheer joyful happiness that some people have as they go through life.
When you look at where you are on the professional side, when you are looking at what you are looking at, what we are looking at right now as a nation and the place that we're at, do you feel, a lot of us feel like we don't know where we are and what we're doing. Are you still getting a handle on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's what I spend a lot of my time. I think a lot of the people who really know what they're doing, some of the people who I think want to divide us as a country and appeal to our base natures, they know where we are, they know what we're doing, and they enjoy the division and the building of walls between people. And I think one of the things for those of us who, you know, would like to remain united as a people and reunited across our different communities, we've been sort of back on our heels. We've been surprised by history. We've been dispersed. And we haven't really gotten together to figure out what we believe. And so a lot of what I spend my time doing is, like, I know what I'm against, but I kind of feel homeless. Like, what am I for? Who are my people? What's my community? And so I've been trying to figure out, like, what am I for? What are we for? And how do we build a community so we're not just angry at somebody else, but we're actually for something we can believe in.
Is that, it's hard to get your mind around, though, isn't it?
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of things that I cherish about the country, first, our ability to have honest discussions about things, have a democracy that's all about deliberation. Second, our ability to live up to what our founders believed in, that we're really a promised land, that we're a people who cross, who left oppression, crossed the wilderness, and we're trying to build a promised land, a country we can really be proud of and have faith in. And just the idea of civility and tolerance and deliberation, respect for facts. We've sort of believed in that so much, we took it for granted, and we forgot how to argue for the things that really make the country the one we love. And so in times of threat, we've got to go back to first principles and figure out, you know, what are we for? What are the arguments that make us for these things? And how are we, can we once again unify around them?
As a political commentator, do you look at this as a time that is rich for you, or do you find it achingly frustrating?
Both. You know, I think the richness comes in, there are some times in history where there are just transitional moments, and you find countries all around the world facing the same problem. 1848 was like that kind of country. 1776 was that kind of year. I think 1905 in the Progressive Era, 1968, you know, there was all that tumult. And I think we're in one of those moments where countries all around the world are facing populism, they're facing disgust with government, and they're trying to figure out, how do we get this back on track? And so to live in a time like this, it makes me very curious. Like, I really want to know what's going to come next, or with the next tweet storm. And it's also a thing, I think, where it gives us a chance to think about this together and figure out how we're going to redirect our history. I really remain fundamentally optimistic about the country. You know, we go through these rough patches when you end one era and you enter another. Like, 1968 was a pretty rough era. We had riots, we had assassinations, Vietnam. But we sort of figured it out, and we had another 20 or 30 years where we made some progress on some things. Now we sort of run at the string on that period. And we're in a rough era, but we'll find another solution. I have just tremendous faith in human ingenuity.
When it comes to human ingenuity, is that in how we vote? Is that how we live our lives? Is that all of the above?
Well, I think it's fundamentally in community healing. As I say, I think the fundamental problem here is we've just become divided from one another.
Right.
And yet everywhere I go around the country, I find people who are rebuilding community on the local level. I was on a Navajo reservation in New Mexico, and a couple had come down from Minnesota to help 60-year-old ex-cons with their drug addiction problems. You know, it's not glamorous work. And the day I visited them, they had $17 in their bank account. But they're doing it, and those people are everywhere. And somehow my hope is, out of all the people doing good work on the local level, somehow we can build a national movement to, you know, in the way this, you know, the civil rights movement was built, the feminist movement was built. You start with a lot of diverse local things and you build it into one big national thing.
So how does the President of the United States, Donald Trump, how does he figure into all of this?
My view is that he's the wrong answer to the right question, that a lot of people felt disenfranchised. They felt that the system just wasn't working for them. And so a lot of the Trump voters I know, you know, they're not totally in love with his character, and they wish he wouldn't tweet, but they needed a change, and he was their shot at change. And so they're pretty realistic. To me, he's not the right answer. I don't think his policies are the right answers. But I understand why people put him into office. And so to me, the big question is, you know, what comes after Trump? What are the alternatives to Trump? And so that's more or less where I'm at.
But we are still in a very a time full of tumult. There's still a lot going on because of, as you say, the tweet storms and the verbal bombs that he throws. So does that make it more difficult, especially if our goal is to come together in some way?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, partly he just scares the dickens out of you from time to time. At least he does me when he's bragging that his nuclear button is bigger than the North Korean's nuclear button. But, you know, I wrote a column a couple of weeks ago likening him to Abbie Hoffman. And if you remember, in the 60s,
sure,
there was this guy, Abbie Hoffman, who wasn't like a deep thinker, but he was sort of a clown jester. And he was good at putting on little theatrical performances that poked holes in the rotten old system. And in some ways, Donald Trump is like the Abbie Hoffman of our day. He doesn't always have a lot constructive to do, but he takes any weakness in our body politic, any division in our society, and he pokes at it, and he exposes the problem. And so it's super nerve-wracking to be covering politics these days, because I've got to cover every time he goes after Steve Bannon in a tweet, or North Korea, or all the millions of people he goes after in these tweets, including me sometimes. But I try not to get swept up in every last dash of his his mind, which flies all over the place.
David Brooks will be at Proctor's Theater in Schenectady, New York on Wednesday night at 7:30, Wednesday, January 17th at 7:30. You can find out more information at proctors.org, proctors.org. David Brooks, a great pleasure, as always, to have you on the program. Thank you very much. We look forward to having you in town.
I'm grateful. Be there soon.
Thank you very much. Again, David Brooks will be at Proctor's Theater in Schenectady January 17th at 7:30, proctors.org, for more information. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.